Chapter 13. The Coffee Room of Flatoms. So Boy Jim went down to the George at Crawley, under the charge of Jim Belcher and Champion Harrison, to train for his great fight with Crab Wilson of Gloucester, whilst every club and bar parlor of London rang with the account of how he had appeared at a supper of Corinthians and beaten the formidable Joe Burks in 4 rounds. I remembered that afternoon at Friar's Oak, when Jim had told me that he would make his name known, and his words had come true sooner than he could have expected it, for, go where one might, one heard of nothing but the match between Sir Lothian Hume and Sir Charles Tregellis, and the points of the two probable combatants. The betting was still steadily in favor of Wilson, for he had a number of bye battles to set against this single victory of Jim's, and it was thought by connoisseurs who had seen him spar that the singular defensive tactics which had given him his nickname would prove very puzzling to a raw antagonist. In height, strength, and reputation for gameness there was very little to choose between them, but Wilson had been the more severely tested. It was but a few days before the battle that my father made his promised visit to London. The seaman had no love of cities, and was happier wandering over the downs, and turning his glass upon every topsail which showed above the horizon, than when finding his way among crowded streets, where, as he complained, it was impossible to keep a course by the sun, and hard enough by dead reckoning. Rumors of war were in the air, however, and it was necessary that he should use his influence with Lord Nelson if a vacancy were to be found either for himself or for me. My uncle had just set forth, as was his custom of an evening, clad in his green riding frock, his plate buttons, his cordovan boots, and his round hat, to show himself upon his crop-tailed tit in the mall. I had remained behind, for, indeed, I had already made up my mind that I had no calling for this fashionable life. These men, with their small waists, their gestures, and their unnatural ways, had become wearisome to me, and even my uncle, with his cold and patronizing manner, filled me with very mixed feelings. My thoughts were back in Sussex, and I was dreaming of the kindly simple ways of the country, when there came a rat-tat at the knocker, the ring of a hearty voice, and there, in the doorway, was the smiling, weather-beaten face, with the puckered eyelids and the light blue eyes. "Why, Roddy, you are grand indeed," he cried. "But I had rather see you with the king's blue coat upon your back than with all these frills and ruffles. And I had rather wear it, father. It warms my heart to hear you say so. Lord Nelson has promised me that he would find a berth for you, and tomorrow we shall seek him out and remind him of it. But where is your uncle? He is riding in the mall." A look of relief passed over my father's honest face, for he was never very easy in his brother-in-law's company. "Have been to the Admiralty," said he, "and I trust that I shall have a ship when war breaks out. By all accounts it will not be long first. Lord St. Vincent told me so with his own lips. But I am at Flatoms, Rodney, where, if you will come and sup with me, you will see some of my messmates from the Mediterranean. When you think that in the last year of the war we had 140,000 seamen and mariners afloat, commanded by 4,000 officers, and that half of these had been turned adrift when the Peace of Amiens laid their ships up in the Amazer Portsdown Creek, you will understand that London, as well as the dockyard towns, was full of seafarers. You could not walk the streets without catching sight of the gypsy-faced, keen-eyed men whose plain clothes told of their thin purses as plainly as their listless air showed their weariness of a life of forced and unaccustomed inaction. Amid the dark streets and brick houses there was something out of place in their appearance, as when the seagulls, driven by stress of weather, are seen in the Midland Shires. Yet while prize courts procrastinated, or there was a chance of an appointment, by showing their sunburned faces at the Admiralty, so long they would continue to pace with their quarter-deck strut down Whitehall, or to gather of an evening, to discuss the events of the last war, or the chances of the next at Flatoms, in Oxford Street, which was reserved as entirely for the Navy as Slaughter's was for the Army, or Ibbotson's for the Church of England. It did not surprise me, therefore, that we should find the large room in which we supped crowded with naval men, But I remember that what did cause me some astonishment was to observe that all these sailors, who had served under the most varying conditions in all quarters of the globe, from the Baltic to the East Indies, should have been molded into so uniform a type that they were more like each other than brother is commonly to brother. The rules of the service ensured that every face should be clean-shaven, every head powdered, and every neck covered by the little queue of natural hair tied with a black silk ribbon. Biting winds and tropical suns had combined to darken them, whilst the habit of command and the menace of ever-recurring dangers had stamped them all with the same expression of authority and of alertness. There were some jovial faces amongst them, but the older officers, with their deep-lined cheeks and their masterful noses, were, for the most part, as austere as so many weather-beaten ascetics from the desert. Lonely watches, and a discipline which cut them off from all companionship, had left their mark upon those red Indian faces. For my part, I could hardly eat my supper for watching them. Young as I was, I knew that, if there were any freedom left in Europe it was to these men, that we owed it, and I seemed to read upon their grim, harsh features the record of that long 10 years of struggle which had swept the tricolor from the seas. When we had finished our supper, my father led me into the great coffee room, where 100 or more officers may have been assembled, drinking their wine and smoking their long clay pipes, until the air was as thick as the main deck in a close-fought action. As we entered, we found ourselves face to face with an elderly officer who was coming out. He was a man with large, thoughtful eyes, and a full, placid face, such a face as one would expect from a philosopher and a philanthropist, rather than from a fighting seaman. "Here's Cutie Collingwood," whispered my father. "Hallo, Lieutenant Stone," cried the famous admiral very cheerily. "I have scarce caught a glimpse of you since you came aboard the Excellent after St. Vincent. You had the luck to be at the Nile also, I understand?" "I was third of the Theseus, under Miller, sir. It nearly broke my heart to have missed it. I have not yet outlived it. To think of such a gallant service, and I engaged in harassing the market boats, the miserable cabbage carriers of St. Lucar's." "Your plight was better than mine, Sir Cuthbert," said a voice from behind us, and a large man in the full uniform of a post-captain took a step forward, to include himself in our circle. His mastiff face was heavy with emotion, and he shook his head miserably as he spoke. "Yes, yes, Troubridge, I can understand and sympathize with your feelings. I passed through torment that night, Collingwood. It left a mark on me that I shall never lose until I go over the ship's side in a canvas cover. To have my beautiful Culloden laid on a sandbank just out of gunshot. To hear and see the fight the whole night through, and never to pull a lanyard, or take the tompions out of my guns. Twice I opened my pistol case to blow out my brains, and it was but the thought that Nelson might have a use for me that held me back." Collingwood shook the hand of the unfortunate captain. "Admiral Nelson was not long in finding a use for you, Troubridge," said he. "Ye have all heard of your siege of Capua, and how you ran up your ship's guns without trenches or parallels, and fired point-blank through the embrasures." The melancholy cleared away from the massive face of the big seaman, and his deep laughter filled the room. "I'm not clever enough, or slow enough for their ZZ fashions," said he. "Ye got alongside, and slapped it in through their portholes until they struck their colors. But where have you been, Sir Cuthbert? With my wife and my two little lasses at Morpeth in the North Country. I have but seen them this once in 10 years, and it may be 10 more, for all I know, ere I see them again. I have been doing good work for the fleet up yonder. I had thought, sir, that it was inland," said my father. Collingwood took a little black bag out of his pocket and shook it. "Inland it is," said he, "and yet I have done good work for the fleet there. What do you suppose I hold in this bag?" "Bullets," said Troubridge. "Something that a sailor needs even more than that," answered the admiral, and turning it over he tilted a pile of acorns onto his palm. "Carry them with me in my country walks, and where I see a fruitful nook I thrust one deep with the end of my cane. My oak trees may fight those rascals over the water, when I am long forgotten. Do you know, Lieutenant, how many yokes go to make an 80-gun ship? My father shook his head. 2,000, no less. For every 2-decked ship that carries the white ensign, there is a grove the less in England. So how are our grandsons to beat the French if we do not give them the trees with which to build their ships? He replaced his bag in his pocket, and then, passing his arm through Troubridge's, they went through the door together. There's a man whose life might help you to trim your own course, said my father, as we took our seats at a vacant table. He is ever the same quiet gentleman, with his thoughts busy for the comfort of his ship's company, and his heart with his wife and children whom he has so seldom seen. It is said in the fleet that an oath has never passed his lips, Rodney, though how he managed when he was first lieutenant of a raw crew is more than I can conceive. But they all love Cutie, for they know he's an angel to fight. How do you do, Captain Foley? My respects, Sir Edard. Why, if they could but press the company, they would man a corvette with flag officers. There's many a man here, Rodney, continued my father, as he glanced about him, whose name may never find its way into any book save his own ship's log, but who in his own way has set as fine an example as any admiral of them all. We know them, and talk of them in the fleet, though they may never be bawled in the streets of London. There's as much seamanship and pluck in a good cutter action as in a lino-battleship fight, though you may not come by a title, nor the thanks of Parliament for it. There's Hamilton, for example, the quiet, pale-faced man who is learning against the pillar. It was he who, with 6 rowing boats, cut out the 44-gun frigate Hermione from under the muzzles of 200 shore guns in the harbor of Puerto Cabello. No finer action was done in the whole war. There's Jahiel Brenton, with the whiskers. It was he who attacked 12 Spanish gunboats in his one little brig, and made 4 of them strike to him. There's Walker, of the Rose Cutter, who, with 13 men, engaged 3 French privateers with crews of 146. He sank one, captured one, and chased the third. How are you, Captain Ball? I hope I see you well. 2 or 3 of my father's acquaintances who had been sitting close by drew up their chairs to us, and soon quite a circle had formed, all talking loudly, and arguing upon sea matters, shaking their long, red-tipped pipes at each other as they spoke. My father whispered in my ear that his neighbor was Captain Foley, of the Goliath, who led the van at the Nile, and that the tall, thin, foxy-haired man opposite was Lord Cochrane, the most dashing frigate captain in the service. Even at Friar's Oak we had heard how, in the little Speedy, of 14 small guns with 54 men, he had carried by boarding the Spanish frigate Gamo with her crew of 300. It was easy to see that he was a quick, irascible, high-blooded man, for he was talking hotly about his grievances with a flush of anger upon his freckled cheeks. We shall never do any good upon the ocean until we have hanged the dockyard contractors, he cried. We have a dead dockyard contractor as a figurehead for every first rate in the fleet, and a provision dealer for every frigate. I know them with their putty seams and their devil bolts, risking 500 lives, that they may steal a few pounds worth of copper. What became of the Chance, and of the Martin, and of the Orestes? They foundered at sea, and were never heard of more, and I say that the crews of them were murdered men. Lord Cochrane seemed to be expressing the views of all, for a murmur of assent, with a mutter of hearty, deep-sea curses, ran round the circle. Those rascals over yonder manage things better, said an old one-eyed captain, with the blue and white ribbon for St. Vincent peeping out of his third buttonhole. Hey, sheer away their heads, if they get up to any foolery. Did ever a vessel come out of Towlin as my 38-gun frigate did from Plymouth last year, with her masts rolling about until her shrouds were like iron bars on one side and hanging in festoons upon the other? The meanest sloop that ever sailed out of France would have overmatched her, and then it would be on me, and not on this Devonport bungler, that a court-martial would be called. They loved to grumble, those old salts, for as soon as one had shot off his grievance his neighbor would follow with another, each more bitter than the last. Look at our sails, cried Captain Foley. A French and a British ship at anchor together, and how can you tell which is which? Frenchie has his fore and main top gallant masts about equal, said my father. In the old ships, maybe, but how many of the new are laid down on the French model? No, there's no way of telling them at anchor. But let them hoist sail, and how do you tell them then? Frenchie has white sails, cried several. And ours are black and rotten. That's the difference. No wonder they outsail us, when the wind can blow through our canvas. In the Speedy, said Cochrane, the sailcloth was so thin that, when I made my observation, I always took my meridian through the foretopsail, and my horizon through the foresail. There was a general laugh at this, and then at it, they all went again, letting off into speech all those weary broodings, and silent troubles which had rankled during long years of service, for an iron discipline prevented them from speaking, when their feet were upon their own quarter decks. One told of his powder, 6 pounds of which were needed to throw a ball 1,000 yards. Another cursed the Admiralty courts, where a prize goes in as a full-rigged ship, and comes out as a schooner. The old captain spoke of the promotions by parliamentary interest which had put many a youngster into the captain's cabin, when he should have been in the gun room. And then they came back to the difficulty of finding crews for their vessels, and they all together raised up their voices and wailed. What is the use of building fresh ships? Cried Foley, when even with a 10-pound bounty you can't man the ships that you have got. But Lord Cochrane was on the other side in this question. You'd have the men, sir, if you treated them well when you got them, said he. Admiral Nelson can get his ships manned. So can Admiral Collingwood. Why? Because he has thought for the men, and so the men have thought for him. Let men and officers know, and respect each other, and there's no difficulty in keeping a ship's company. It's the infernal plan of turning a crew over from ship to ship, and leaving the officers behind that rots the Navy. But I have never found a difficulty, and I dare swear that, if I hoist my pennant tomorrow I shall have all my old speedies back, and as many volunteers as I care to take. That is very well, my lord, said the old captain, with some warmth. When the Jacks hear that the Speedy took 50 vessels in 13 months, they are sure to volunteer to serve with her commander. Every good cruiser can fill her complement quickly enough. But it is not the cruisers that fight the country's battles and blockade the enemy's ports. I say that all prize money should be divided equally among the whole fleet, and until you have such a rule, the smartest men will always be found, where they are of least service to anyone but themselves. This speech produced a chorus of protests from the cruiser officers, and a hearty agreement from the line of battleship men, who seemed to be in the majority in the circle which had gathered round. From the flushed faces and angry glances it was evident that the question was one upon which there was strong feeling upon both sides. What the cruiser gets, the cruiser earns, cried a frigate captain. Do you mean to say, sir, said Captain Foley, that the duties of an officer upon a cruiser demand more care or higher professional ability than those of one who is employed upon blockade service, with a lee coast under him, whenever the wind shifts to the west, and the topmasts of an enemy's squadron forever in his sight? I do not claim higher ability, sir. Then why should you claim higher pay? Can you deny that a seaman before the mast makes more in a fast frigate than a lieutenant can in a battleship? It was only last year, said a very gentlemanly-looking officer, who might have passed for a buck upon town, had his skin not been burned to copper in such sunshine as never bursts upon London. It was only last year that I brought the old Alexander back from the Mediterranean, floating like an empty barrel and carrying nothing but honor for her cargo. In the channel we fell in with the frigate Minerva from the Western Ocean, with her lee ports underwater and her hatches bursting with the plunder which had been too valuable to trust to the prize crews. She had ingots of silver along her yards and bowsprit, and a bit of silver plate at the truck of the masts. My jacks could have fired into her, and would too, if they had not been held back. It made them mad to think of all they had done in the south, and then to see this saucy frigate flashing her money before their eyes. I cannot see their grievance, Captain Ball, said Cochrane. When you are promoted to a two-decker, my lord, it will possibly become clearer to you. You speak as if a cruiser had nothing to do but take prizes. If that is your view, you will permit me to say that you know very little of the matter. I have handled a sloop, a corvette, and a frigate, and I have found a great variety of duties in each of them. I have had to avoid the enemy's battleships, and to fight his cruisers. I have had to chase, and capture his privateers, and to cut them out when they run under his batteries. I have had to engage his forts, to take my men ashore, and to destroy his guns and his signal stations. All this, with convoying, reconnoitering, and risking one's own ship in order to gain a knowledge of the enemy's movements, comes under the duties of the commander of a cruiser. I make bold to say that the man who can carry these objects out with success has deserved better of the country than the officer of a battleship, tacking from Ushant to the Black Rocks and back again until she builds up a reef with her beef bones. Sir, said the angry old sailor, such an officer is at least in no danger of being mistaken for a privateersman. I am surprised, Captain Bulkley, Cochrane retorted hotly, that you should venture to couple the names of privateersman and king's officer. There was mischief brewing among these hot-headed, short-spoken salts, but Captain Foley changed the subject to discuss the new ships which were being built in the French ports. It was of interest to me to hear these men, who were spending their lives in fighting against our neighbors, discussing their character and ways. You cannot conceive, you who live in times of peace and charity, how fierce the hatred was in England at that time against the French, and above all against their great leader. It was more than a mere prejudice or dislike. It was a deep, aggressive loathing of which you may even now form some conception, if you examine the papers or caricatures of the day. The word Frenchman was hardly spoken without a seal, or scoundrel slipping in before it. In all ranks of life and in every part of the country the feeling was the same. Even the jacks aboard our ships fought with a viciousness against a French vessel which they would never show to Dane, Dutchman, or Spaniard. If you ask me now, after 50 years, why it was that there should have been this virulent feeling against them, so foreign to the easy-going and tolerant British nature, I would confess that I think the real reason was fear. Not fear of them individually, of course our foulest detractors have never called us faint-hearted, but fear of their star, fear of their future, fear of the subtle brain whose plans always seemed to go aright, and of the heavy hand which had struck nation after nation to the ground. We were but a small country, with a population which, when the war began, was not much more than half that of France. And then, France had increased by leaps and bounds, reaching out to the north into Belgium and Holland, and to the south into Italy, whilst we were weakened by deep-lying disaffection among both Catholics and Presbyterians in Ireland. The danger was imminent, and plain to the least thoughtful. One could not walk the Kent coast without seeing the beacons heaped up to tell the country of the enemy's landing, and if the sun were shining on the uplands near Bowland, one might catch the flash of its gleam upon the bayonets of maneuvering veterans. No wonder that a fear of the French power lay deeply in the hearts of the most gallant men, and that fear should, as it always does, beget a bitter and rancorous hatred. The seamen did not speak kindly then of their recent enemies. Their hearts loathed them, and in the fashion of our country their lips said what the heart felt. Of the French officers they could not have spoken with more chivalry, as of worthy foemen, but the nation was an abomination to them. The older men had fought against them in the American War, they had fought again for the last 10 years, and the dearest wish of their hearts seemed to be that they might be called upon to do the same for the remainder of their days. Yet if I was surprised by the virulence of their animosity against the French, I was even more so, to hear how highly they rated them as antagonists. The long succession of British victories which had finally made the French take to their ports, and resign the struggle in despair, had given all of us the idea that for some reason a Briton on the water must, in the nature of things, always have the best of it against a Frenchman. But these men who had done the fighting did not think so. They were loud in their praise of their foeman's gallantry, and precise in their reasons for his defeat. they showed how the officers of the old French Navy had nearly all been aristocrats, how the revolution had swept them out of their ships, and the forcemen left with insubordinate seamen and no competent leaders. This ill-directed fleet had been hustled into port by the pressure of the well-manned and well-commanded British, who had pinned them there ever since, so that they had never had an opportunity of learning seamanship. Their harbor drill and their harbor gunnery had been of no service, when sails had to be trimmed, and broadsides fired on the heave of an Atlantic swell. Let one of their frigates get to sea, and have a couple of years free run in which the crew might learn their duties, and then it would be a feather in the cap of a British officer, if with a ship of equal force he could bring down her colors. Such were the views of these experienced officers, fortified by many reminiscences and examples of French gallantry, such as the way in which the crew of the L'Orient had fought her quarter-deck guns when the main deck was in a blaze beneath them, and when they must have known that they were standing over an exploding magazine. The general hope was that the West Indian expedition since the peace might have given many of their fleet an ocean training, and that they might be tempted out into mid-channel if the war were to break out afresh. But would it break out afresh? We had spent gigantic sums and made enormous exertions to curb the power of Napoleon and to prevent him from becoming the universal despot of Europe. Would the government try it again? Or were they appalled by the gigantic load of debt which must bend the backs of many generations unborn? Pitt was there, and surely he was not a man to leave his work half done. And then suddenly there was a bustle at the door. Amid the gray swirl of the tobacco smoke I could catch a glimpse of a blue coat and gold epaulettes, with a crowd gathering thickly round them, while a hoarse murmur rose from the group which thickened into a deep-chested cheer. Everyone was on his feet, peering, and asking each other what it might mean. And still the crowd ceased and the cheering swelled. "What is it? What has happened?" cried a score of voices. "Put him up! Hoist him up!" shouted somebody, and an instant later I saw Captain Troubridge appear above the shoulders of the crowd. His face was flushed, as if he were in wine, and he was waving what seemed to be a letter in the air. The cheering died away, and there was such a hush that I could hear the crackle of the paper in his hand. "Great news, gentlemen," he roared. "Glorious news. Rear Admiral Collingwood has directed me to communicate it to you. The French ambassador has received his papers tonight. Every ship on the list is to go into commission. Admiral Cornwallis is ordered out of Cossand Bay to cruise off Ushant. A squadron is starting for the North Sea, and another for the Irish Channel." He may have had more to say, but his audience could wait no longer. How they shouted and stamped and raved in their delight. Harsh old flag officers, grave post captains, young lieutenants, all were roaring like schoolboys breaking up for the holidays. There was no thought now of those manifold and weary grievances to which I had listened. The foul weather was past, and the landlocked seabirds would be out on the foam once more. The rhythm of "God Save the King" swelled through the Babel, and I heard the old lines sung in a way that made you forget their bad rhymes and their bald sentiments. I trust that you will never hear them so sung, with tears upon rugged cheeks, and catchings of the breath from strong men. Dark days will have come again before you hear such a song, or see such a sight as that. Let those talk of the phlegm of our countrymen who have never seen them, when the lava crust of restraint is broken, and when for an instant the strong, enduring fires of the north glow upon the surface. I saw them then, and if I do not see them now, I am not so old, or so foolish, as to doubt that they are there. Gutenberg Edition. End of chapter.